Welcome back to the program. It's no surprise that the world's financial markets are shrouded in secrecy. We don't need a whistleblower to tell us that. But in an age in which what happens in Greece or China or Singapore can have ripple effects in financial markets around the world, often in seconds, it's certainly important to understand where the world's levers of financial power truly are. They're no longer just in big banks or big governments, but like so much of globalization, they rest in multinational organizations, often far, far removed from the people they impact. One such organization is the Bank for International Settlement. It meets every other month in Basel, Switzerland, and its work is often hidden, while its impact is not. My guest, Adam Labor, pulls back the curtain in his new book, Tower of Basel, The Shadowy History of the Secret Bank That Runs the World. Adam Labor is a journalist, literary critic. He writes for The Economist, The Times of London, and Monocle. He's the author of seven previous books, including the groundbreaking Hitler's Secret Bankers. And it is my pleasure to welcome Adam Labor here to talk about Tower of Basel, The Shadowy History of the Secret Bank That Runs the World. Adam Labor, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
It's great to have you here. Tell us about this Bank of International Settlements. When did it get started, and what was its initial purpose?
Well, the Bank for International Settlements, the BIS, was set up in 1930, and its initial purpose was quite obscure and technical, was to manage German reparations payments for the First World War. After Germany lost the First World War, the Allies decided that it was essentially Germany's fault, and they had to pay for the costs and the damages of the war. And all through the 1920s, a lot of wrangling and arguments. And finally, there was something agreed called the Young Plan under the chairmanship of Owen Young, an American diplomat and politician and businessman. And that's kind of laid out how much the Germans were going to pay. And the idea was they would pay it through the BIS. But the real reason the BIS was set up was to have a place for central bankers to meet. Central bankers are the governors of national and central banks, like Ben Bernanke, chairman of the Federal Reserve, Sir Mervyn King, the governor of the Bank of England, Mario Draghi, the president of the European Central Bank, the contemporary central bankers. And what's interesting, really fascinating about the BIS is that it was set up under an international treaty, so it has extremely high levels of legal and diplomatic protection, same as similar to the UN or an embassy. But it is a commercial bank. It's the world's only commercial bank protected by international treaty.
And how is this different in terms of its membership than things like the IMF and other multinational financial organizations that also incorporate the head of the world's central banks?
Well, the IMF is a fund. And it's the IMF is not a bank in itself. So the thing about the Bank for International Settlements is that it really is a bank. The member banks, the 60 or so founding member banks who own shares in the bank, have accounts there, and the bank offers commercial and trading services to other central banks. For example, it will arrange gold swaps and foreign currency exchange deals and sort out short-term liquidity. If a country needs money in a hurry, it provides investment services for the central banks of smaller countries. Say you're the president of the National Bank of Macedonia in Eastern Europe. You know, you don't really have the level of expertise that they have at the BIS. So the BIS can help you manage your reserves.
And how does the bank today fit into the international monetary and regulatory architecture that we see today?
Well, the bank is a crucial and a key part of the international monetary and regulatory architecture, because the bank hosts many of the most important organizations that are dealing with this. For example, the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision meets and is hosted at the BIS and has been essentially ever since it was set up in the 1970s. Now, the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision regulates commercial banks, not central banks, and it has the famous 8% rule that any bank lending and trading internationally has to keep 8% of the equivalent of 8% of its assets in kind of liquidity. And you know, that's, it's much more complicated than that, but that's broadly what it means. So that's hosted at the BIS, and then a lot of other important regulatory authorities are hosted there to do with insurance and also the Financial Stability Board, which is a comparatively new body which combines the central banks and the regulatory authorities. You know, and their aim, you know, is good. It's to avoid future crashes, to keep the financial system, you know, flowing freely.
In that framework, how good a job has it done, and what role did it play, for example, during the recent European economic crisis?
Well, the bank's been at the... What happens at the bank, the most important thing that happens at the bank at the moment, is every 2 months, the 60 central bankers, the central bankers of the largest and most important economies in the world, or many of them, come to Basel to meet. And they have these meetings to discuss monetary policy and the financial crisis. So during the crisis, the bank's been a key point for coordination of responses to the crisis. And they're called the Basel weekends. They're bi-monthly, every other month. And what happens is that the central bankers, such as Ben Bernanke or someone else from the Federal Reserve, and the president, the chairman of the New York Federal Reserve, and Mervyn King, and the governor of Bank of France, etc., they all fly into Basel either on a Saturday or a Sunday. On the Sunday night, the top 18 have a dinner, which is really the key thing, where during the financial crisis, this dinner was very important. It's where a lot of the discussions took place about what to do and how to deal with the crisis and low interest rates and do they work and do they not work. And then on Monday, there's what's called the global economy meeting, where 30 countries meet at the initial 18, plus bigger countries like Turkey and Poland. And then after that, there's the meeting where all 60 member banks meet. But the key point about this is that these meetings are all secret. Although we know who can attend them, we don't know who does attend them, we don't know what they talk about, and we don't know what the minutes, there's no minutes release, there's no agenda release, there's almost, usually there's no press conference. So why I call the bank, you know, secret is that these are public servants, governors of central banks. We're paying their salary, we're paying their pension, you know, we're paying their plane tickets, and we have a right to know something of what they're talking about.
How has the role of the bank changed as the world has become more global in terms of the free flow of capital around the world?
Well, it's changed immensely. But one of the interesting things about the bank is that it was essentially the birthplace, I argue, of the global financial technocrat. I mean, if you ever step back and you think, say, look at Greece, you know, the Troika, the European Central Bank and the IMF and the European Union, they come in and they're telling a sovereign country what to do. Well, how did that happen? How did we get here? And we got here, I argue, partly, in large part, through the BIS, because during the 1930s, as there's a lot of money, you know, money was starting to move around the world more freely, not nearly as freely as today, but there was especially an awful lot of money going across from America to Europe and to Germany in particular, to Nazi Germany. And the BIS was part of that system, an essential part, and it was also where the first bailouts were organized when the Hungarian and the Austrian and the Spanish economies got into trouble. You know, emergency lending and credit was extended from the BIS. So that's where it started. And then during the Second World War, the BIS was the prime point of contact for the secret negotiations between the Allies and the Nazis over what the post-war financial system would look like. So what does that mean? For example, Per Jacobson, who was a Swedish economist who worked at the BIS from 1931 to 1956, comes to the States in 1942, has lots of high-powered meetings at the U.S. Treasury and the State Department because they're planning, you know, how's the world going to look after the war is over, comes back to Europe and then goes off to Berlin to see Emil Poole, who's the vice president of the Reichsbank, the Nazi central bank, and a director of the BIS, and they have a nice discussion about, you know, post-war planning. So, you know, I found this kind of horrifying, really, that while, you know, in Basel, the channels of money are being kept open just a few miles away over the border, you know, young Americans and British soldiers are fighting and dying, which is why Henry Morgenthau and his assistant Harry Dexter White really were pushing for the BIS to be closed down. You know, Harry Dexter White put it very well. He said the president of the bank, an American, Thomas McKittrick's doing business with the Germans while our boys are fighting the Germans.
In the world today, though, given the tremendous interconnection of financial markets, the speed at which those financial markets operate around the world, is an institution like this more critical than ever before in order to keep things in some kind of balance?
Yeah, I mean, you can argue it either way with the BIS. I mean, the BIS is a bank, first and foremost. So it provides banking services for central banks. Now, there's no reason why those banking services couldn't be provided by commercial banks. It doesn't, if they sign sufficient guarantees of confidentiality. It has a very good research department, but the research department could exist elsewhere. You know, the meetings of the bankers could take place in a hotel. So there's really no particular reason for it to exist, but it does exist and will carry on existing. And it does serve a useful function in the sense of being a contact point, as you say, in a world where vast amounts of money can fly around literally in microseconds or nanoseconds with big knock-on effects for all of us. Yeah, I mean, the contacts are useful there. So Mervyn King told me that the contacts that he'd made there with his American equivalents meant that when there was a crisis on that, you know, they could phone each other, they'd got to know each other, they trusted each other. But my argument is that the structure of the bank is essentially a hangover from the 1930s, you know, from the age of deference to authority, when people like the central bankers said, you know, don't worry, we know what's best for you. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you look at the results of what's going on in the world, they don't know what's best for us, and we need more accountability.
And is that the largest part of your argument, that the bank needs more transparency and more accountability?
Yes. I mean, the book, I call it the first investigative history. Mm-hmm. So, I'm peeling back what happened in the 1930s during the Second World War, how the bank was really the prime motive behind the creation of the euro for the first 40 or 50 years after the Second World War, up until the 1990s when the euro was launched. Almost all of the technical and preparatory work for that was taking place at the BIS. You know, it's like the brains trust behind the euro, which I found very interesting. So those are the things that I'm exploring. But yes, nowadays my argument is very strong that we just need to know a bit more about what's going on in there. And the bank has very high protections of legal and diplomatic immunity. I mean, it's essentially extraterritorial, like an embassy, in the sense that the Swiss authorities need the permission of the bank's management to enter, and its assets are inviolable. They could never be confiscated, even if there's a war. And I think people, we the citizens of the country that are sending the central bankers there to talk about things, should have some information about what they're talking about. Now, the central bankers say, oh, but, you know, you want to put a camera in the room and put out a transcript and nobody will say anything and the meetings will be useless. And, you know, this is always the response of people in power when there's a push for transparency. They present this ridiculous scenario. But I'm not saying that you put a camera in the room or release a transcript. I'm just saying I understand that central bankers need to speak confidentially to each other. But central bankers are public servants. You know, this is not J.P. Morgan or Goldman Sachs, which has, you know, commercial confidentiality. We have a right to know more about what they're talking about. And the fact that that works is shown, for example, in the Federal Reserve. Every 2 weeks, it releases the minutes of the previous 2 weeks' meeting, and we have some sense of what's going on and what way the bank is thinking.
What happens to the bank's profits? How are they distributed?
The bank's profits are, they pay out dividends to their members, to the shareholders, and then the rest of those profits go back into the reserve fund of the bank and towards managing the bank. I mean, it is immensely profitable organization.
Talk about that and how profitable it is.
Well, last year it made, for year ending 2012, it made tax-free profits of $1.17 billion, depending on how you calculate the exchange rate. But around that, its profits are, the bank actually keeps its accounts in special drawing rights, which are not actually a currency, but they're kind of like an accounting unit, which is offset against the world's different currencies. But one special drawing right is roughly equivalent to a pound sterling, which means like a dollar and a half.
Talk a little bit about the role that the bank plays in regulating things like interest rates and currency and the influence that it has in those areas.
Well, the bank doesn't actually regulate anything itself.
Right.
The bank is a meeting point. But what happens is, the central banks, the member banks, are doing the regulation in conjunction or not with their governments, depending how independent they are and the various tensions around that, which we've seen a lot of. But the discussions that take place at the bank are where different ideas are raised around monetary policy and helping guide the central banks towards taking the decisions that they do.
Talk about mistakes that you think the bank has made in more recent times and things that might have been dealt with in a better way had there been more transparency.
Well, I think the big mistake at the moment, and I think one that will have a lot of implications for the future of the bank, is the question of the Argentine reserves. After Argentina went bust, it offered around 35 cents on the dollar to holders of its bonds, its state bonds. Now, not everyone accepted those that offer. Most people did, about more than 90% did, but not everybody did. And the ones that didn't have been suing the bank as a group of Italian investors and two funds in New York that are connected to each other. And they've won some court cases in New York and in Europe. But Argentina has moved some of its reserves to the BIS. And the Swiss courts are saying you cannot sue, you know, because the bank is legally inviolable, its assets are protected by international treaty. You know, they're suing the bank in Switzerland, but the Swiss courts are saying, you know, we have no jurisdiction over this. This case has no legal validity here. So that raises interesting questions about the tension between the bank's role as, you know, as an international organization, which purports to be for the public good. And the people in the bank are, you know, do believe and are proud of the fact that, you know, they're rather like working for the UN. They're working for an international organization. It's very profitable, but they argue that's kind of incidental. You know, the BIS was set up as an under international treaty, you know, to serve the world. So that argument doesn't sit so well with the funds that have been, you know, that are suing them.
The bank was very instrumental in establishing the euro. Talk about that.
Yes, the bank's been the center of the technical and preparatory work for establishing the euro. After the 1940s, there was pressure to close the bank down, especially at the Bretton Woods Conference in 1944. But it was, you know, the bank is very clever. It just reinvents itself again and again. Each time it doesn't need to exist, it reinvents itself. So, you know, after the Germans stopped paying reparations in 1932, the bank sort of reinvented itself as the crucial meeting place for central bankers. Then during the Second World War, it's the point of contact between the two sides. Then after the Second World War, you know, there was a very strong sense that because of the Cold War, that we have to rebuild Germany, we have to get the money flowing, we have to open up trade and get the continent working again. You know, and there is an argument for that. And so the bank was at the center of that. And during the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, it managed or hosted or did the banking for these kind of quite obscure things that most people have never heard of, called the European Payments Union and the European Monetary Cooperation Fund. And what they were doing was easing up some of the restrictions on the way the money was flowing, and they were kind of starting to harmonize the currencies, because before the euro was introduced, you know, you can't just slam the lira and the French franc and the Deutsche Mark together like that. They have to be, the fluctuations and exchange rates have to be reduced, and you have to kind of harmonize them. So all of that was taking place at the bank. And then when Jacques Delors, the president of the European Commission, started the serious work in the 1990s building up the euro, the Delors Commission, which, you know, logically should have met in the European Parliament in Brussels or Strasbourg or in the European Commission, actually met at the BIS. And one of the key members of the Delors Commission was a man called Alexandre Lanfalusi, a Hungarian economist, and he was the manager of the BIS. And then in 1994, he set up the European Monetary Institute at the BIS. And then a year later, it left to go to Frankfurt and became the European Central Bank, you know, which, not coincidentally, is another bank protected by international treaty that's quite opaque. So, you know, I call the ECB the son of the BIS.
Do you see any potential changes happening with respect to BIS?
Yes, there are potential changes. Changes have been happening, you know, and the bank argues that it's much more open than it used to be. I mean, it has a website, a quite good website. It doesn't say anything about the banking operations or what's talked about at the meetings, but it gives you an idea of what the bank does. all its annual reports are downloadable, you know, right back to 1930. You know, they're free and open. The bank has a Twitter feed. I mean, most of what's on the Twitter feed is, you know, like links to speeches by other central bankers. It's not, you know, it's very specialized. But they have made some moves towards openness. And I think what will happen is, because now, you know, in the age of Twitter and Facebook and the Arab Springs and everything, people are just around the world demanding more transparency and more accountability. And that is starting to happen.
Adam Labore, the book is Tower of Basel, The Shadowy History of the Secret Bank That Runs the World. It's just out from Public Affairs. Adam, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you for having me on the show.
Appreciate it. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.